Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. More often than not, most of us who live on the Oregon coast probably forget at times that we are residents of the Pacific Rim's Ring of Fire, which is a huge geographical arc of volcanoes and earthquake fault lines. Maritime Southeast Asia has once again provided us a grim preview of the mighty King Kong-sized earthquake that is projected to shake, rattle, and roll the Pacific Northwest at any time between the next second and half a century from now, followed virtually instantly by a mountainous tsunami that will most likely tumble wash the debris our lives will have suddenly become. This past Friday, September 28th, a 7.5 magnitude earthquake on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi, combined with a huge tsunami, killed perhaps 1,000 or more persons and injured thousands more. At least 200 aftershocks followed the main quake, which increased the damages of estimated thousands of homes, hotels, hospitals, shopping centers, as well as badly smashed and washed out roads. It might also be remembered that in December 2004, a 9.1 magnitude earthquake in western Indonesia triggered a tsunami that killed 250,000 people in a dozen countries. The Newport News Times recently addressed our imminent peril on the Oregon coast with an article by managing editor Brett Yeager, which he titled, "Disaster Preparation is Not Optional," with which I start today's program. We can never be prepared enough for the possibility of hugely destructive tsunami waves on our coastline. When the big one hits, sand will liquefy with the shaking, swallowing buildings. Many bridges will topple and roads will become impassable. Responders will do their best, but the sheer magnitude of the earthquake will create challenges that are nearly unimaginable. This is not scaremongering. It's 100% real, and the experts tell us it is only a matter of time before the plates at the Cascadia subduction zone release their grip on each other and release centuries of bottled pressure. Coastal residents must be ready for a prolonged magnitude 9 shaking. Among the effects, severed electrical transmission and water lines, leaving the coast without power for months and without water for up to years. Emergency and medical services will be compromised and overwhelmed, harbors destroyed by waves. Infrastructure will be almost entirely obliterated, and those living outside of the densest areas will be the last to be served. And this is only scratching the surface. So when the Newport Planning Commission worked last month on digesting a new report from state geologists on tsunami evacuation routes, evacuation speeds, and problem areas, it felt like another step in the right direction. But let's gain some perspective by backing up 14 years to when we had not begun to get serious about this problem. In 2004, the world was shocked by the Indian Ocean quake and tsunami. Many of us remember the elephants, which somehow knew they needed to go to higher ground as the wave raced across the sea at the speed of a commercial airliner. Much harder to digest was the fact that more than 230,000 people died in that event and the ensuing humanitarian crisis spurred by the destruction. The tragedy forced Oregon to take a hard look at its own level of preparation. I was a cub reporter at the time, cutting my teeth in Florence by writing stories on tsunami sirens that did not function, a populace that was pretty well uninformed, and a general lack of preparation for an event that scientists believe strikes here every 300 to 600 years. The last big quake and tsunami occurred off of Oregon in the 1700s, according to geological records. Recently, people began to wake up to the danger all along the coast. Fire departments and other responders started leading tsunami evacuation drills. Inundation zones were established and refined based partly on information from the Indian Ocean quake. Signs were put up showing evacuation routes and warning visitors when they were entering danger zones. Blue lines painted across roads and streets showed residents where the water would go. At workshops and preparedness events, people learned how to put away the supplies they would need to tide them over. We began to fathom the geology of our vulnerability. Most of all, people started talking, and preparedness began to ingrain itself in our consciousness. So a lot has already happened. Is it enough? Not even close. Everyone should know the evacuation routes from their home or workplace. We should all put aside enough water, food, and critical medications to last us several weeks, if not months, along with a battery-powered radio, first aid kit, portable propane stove, and fuel, and other supplies detailed on numerous websites which can be found online. Attend a local preparedness fair or other event. Our reporter, Rick Beasley, and emergency planners reveal we had best be ready to fend for ourselves for months. There are also tips on ways that residents can empower themselves. Most of us need to do more than we have. Longtime Walport resident Teresa McCracken told me she is frequently surprised by the lack of preparation among residents. I have an emergency supply kit, she said, but I'm always surprised at the number of people who don't. The experts tell us the same thing. McCracken understood tsunamis in an abstract sense before the 2004 quake, but had not quite grasped the destructive power of the waves until she viewed the videos. It was the beginning of a sea change, reinforced by the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan. I remember watching crabbers taking their boats out across the Newport Bar for the safety of deeper water in the wake of news the waves could reach here. The effects were not dramatic on our coast, but a surge of debris began to move east across the Pacific. A section of a Japanese dock washed up on Agate Beach. I walked on the thing, scuffed it with my feet in a kind of disbelief, thinking about the land it was torn from and how far it had traveled. The threat is real, and we need to keep at it. And that was by Bert Yeager from the Newport News Times. And if you saw on TV or listened on KMUN to Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! On Monday, Uno di Octo, you probably remember the interview with Kimberly Crenshaw that was in context with an article she wrote for the New York Times on September 27th. The following is that article. We still haven't learned from Anita Hill's testimony, and that's by Kimberly Crenshaw. 27 years after Anita Hill testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee that Clarence Thomas sexually harassed her, and as Christian Blasey Ford prepares to testify that Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were teenagers, we still have not learned our mistakes from that mess in 1991. Most people recognize that it looked bad, a black woman fending for herself in front of a group of white men. Yet we can't acknowledge the central tragedy of 1991, the false tension between feminist and anti-racist movements. We are still ignoring the unique vulnerability of black women. I watched Anita Hill testify as a member of her support team. I worried that she would be trapped between an anti-racist movement that foregrounded black men and a feminism that could not fully address how race shaped society's perception of black victims. I thought this subtext might be subtle, but when Clarence Thomas denounced Ms. Hill's testimony as a high-tech lynching, I knew this nuance had exploded into full-scale war. Underlying his comment was the idea that sexual harassment, like the feminism that pointed it out, was a white preoccupation incompatible with anti-racism. The two groups most visible at the Hill-Thomas hearing were at odds with each other. Many white feminists appeared largely unaware of the racial dynamics that shaped the Thomas Hill confrontation, and many people fighting for racial justice, aware of lynching's toll on black men, heeded Judge Thomas's appeal to racial solidarity. They argued past each other, damaging the goal of anti-racist and feminist collaboration, the sort of alliance Ms. Hill's testimony might have in a better world solidified. Meanwhile, Judge Thomas's counterassault contradicted a good deal of legal and political thought. Judge Thomas was an apostle of individualist self-help. Blacks could advance only by pulling themselves up from their own bootstraps. He had long derided the civil rights movement's focus on structural racism and its corresponding calls for structural remedies. So my colleagues and I were stunned as Judge Thomas, who spent years attacking the work of civil rights leaders and his own Black sister, asserted his own racial victimhood. More significantly, Judge Thomas's soundbite instantly divided the white feminists and anti-racists, who might otherwise have been able to unite to block his confirmation. Consider what the other Hill supporters and I saw as we left the Capitol late that evening. A group of African Americans, most of them women, had gathered at the bottom of the steps in song and prayer. At first, we thought it was a mobilization in support of Anita Hill in the great civil rights tradition. But as we drew closer, we heard them praying for the Lord to intercede on Clarence Thomas's behalf, to rescue him from the scheming malice of Anita Hill. We fled and piled into a taxi, only to hear a Black radio talk show host inveighing against Ms. Hill. One caller after another sided with Judge Thomas. We despaired as it became clear that our organizing on Anita Hill's behalf was ineffective in the face of outrage over a Black woman who had dared to turn on a fellow African American at the cusp of enormous judicial power. This complaint echoed across barber shops, churches, and dining rooms across the country. To our distress, Anita Hill was not defended by the most influential Democrats on the Judiciary Committee or by a majority of African Americans. Inside the hearing room, committee members painted her as an angry and sexually deranged woman. Outside, Republican senators described her as having nefarious motives and a dubious background. The Harvard sociologist Orlando Patterson sought to provide a more highbrow analysis. Many Blacks did believe that Judge Thomas likely said those things, but like Dr. Patterson, chastised Ms. Hill for bringing these matters into the public domain. To him, Judge Thomas's repeated pornography-laden harassment against a aloof Anita Hill may have looked like a textbook case of workplace harassment to a white puritanical feminist eye. But it was, in fact, a down-home style accordion that affirmed their shared racial background. It was Anita Hill who was being uppity, who deigned to think that her workplace rights had been denied. Dr. Patterson, of course, wasn't the first person to use a cultural defense to justify the abuse of Black women. The othering of Black women's sexuality has long been a part of American history. This reality informed the talk Black mothers would have with their daughters when they were summoned to work in the big house, the fields, or later in factories. This stereotype has rationalized sexual abuse as culturally sanctioned byplay between male predators of all races and Black female victims. Black women are vulnerable not only because of racial bias against them, but also because of stereotypes that they expect less nurturing. They are more willing. No one will believe them. This is what marks them as prey to men of all races. Long before Anita Hill's poised testimony, Black women knew all too well the many ways in which the mere facts of their race and gender identities made them targets. Feminists rightly denounced the locker room treatment of Ms. Hill by the Judiciary Committee and by the media, but they were largely flat-footed in their efforts to grapple with the racial undertow that sapped her support within the Senate chamber and in much of the African-American community. White feminists cast her as an accomplished lawyer and legal scholar whose race was immaterial. Such colorblind feminism did a profound disservice to Ms. Hill, and it marked another key moment of political erasure, in this case, one that effaced modern feminist history. Treating the racial backdrop of the hearing as just noise meant that we missed an opportunity to create a nuanced understanding of sexual harassment. In the great awakening around sexual harassment, race was politely ushered off stage. The failure of anti-racists and white feminists to counter the racist stereotypes lobbed against Ms. Hill left a gaping hole, so Black feminists filled it. They rallied together to purchase a full-page advertisement in the New York Times titled, "African Women in Defense of Ourselves." The 1,600 signatories noted the racism and sexism playing out in the Hill-Thomas drama. The advertisement showed what the mainstream media was determined to overlook, that Black women were disbelieved and undervalued. In the quarter century since Justice Thomas's confirmation, Ms. Hill has continued to reckon with the failure of Congress and the media to give her a fair hearing. And as sexual harassment has gained more recognition as a legitimate cross-racial grievance, most recently via the Me Too movement, millions of ordinary Americans have come to realize just how badly our institutions had treated Ms. Hill. We can still redress the shameful legacy of the Hill-Thomas confrontation by placing Black women in their rightful place at the center of the fight against sexual predation on and off the job. Black plaintiffs like Sandra Bundy, Michelle Vinson, and Pamela Price, for example, led the way for sexual harassment to be recognized as sex discrimination in landmark cases. Eleanor Holmes Norton was at the vanguard of this work when she was the director of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Writing the history would also mean resurrecting the feminist legacies of the iconic figures of the civil rights movement. It would mean freeing Rosa Parks from that lonely seat on a Montgomery bus and placing her on the damp soil of rural Alabama, where she undertook the dangerous job of defending Recy Taylor, a Black woman gang raped by white men who were never held accountable. It would mean giving the proper due to the unsung legal genius Pauli Murray, whom Ruth Bader Ginsburg credited with advancing the logic of race and gender parallelism that opened up gender discrimination to constitutional scrutiny. Correcting the record would also mean that movements against police violence and gender-based violence should prioritize the abuse of Black women, which has long been a distant afterthought in both. It would also mean that my Brother's Keeper and similar programs would include at-risk girls in their educational and mentorship programs. For too long, racial injustice groups and leading women's groups have been silent about this exclusion or content with underfunded spinoffs that focus on reducing pregnancy rather than enhancing academic achievement. And rectifying the legacy of the Hill-Thomas hearing would mean that anti-racist work against mass incarceration and juvenile justice would also focus on Black girls, not just boys. Throughout history, Black feminist frameworks have been doing the hard work of building the social justice movements that race-only or gender-only frames cannot. Intersectionality, my term for the urgent project of uniting the battles for race and gender justice, is an indispensable way to understand aspects of our history that, to our peril, remain hidden. The Hill-Thomas conflict has gone down in history as a colossal failure of intersectional organizing. It's not too late, as the Kavanaugh nomination fight enters its next phase, to write a better history. And that was by Kimberly Crenshaw. We still haven't learned from Anita Hill's testimony. She is a law professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, and at Columbia Law School, where she is the founder and director of the Center for Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies. She is the author of the forthcoming On Intersectionality. And now, despite all the hoopla, crass promotion, and veritable scamishness that seems to brand every day, week, and month of every year, some are creditworthy, such as among October's 100 or so token commemoratives, it is Domestic Abuse Awareness Month, which segues into October also being the 39th anniversary of the original Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service. I was a volunteer for the crisis service during the early years and wrote this in 1980 for the North Coast Times Eagle, beating her up. The woman had been beaten by her husband. He raped her also, then tore up the house. Now he was in jail and she was afraid of what he would do to her when he was released. She called the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service in Astoria. She was told that a man had no legal right to hurt his wife and that she could press charges against him. There were other problems. Her husband's parents had the children and refused to give them up to her. She was also addicted to Valium. That night, she called the crisis service a second time and asked if anyone would take her to a hospital. She had attempted suicide with an overdose of Valium preceded by heavy drinking of alcohol. She was afraid her husband would kill her if she attempted to keep him in jail, she told the woman from the crisis service, who drove her to the emergency room. The woman from the crisis service said she would accompany her to the police station. She said it was important to fight back against her husband's brutality. She knew firsthand about domestic violence, the crisis service woman said. She had herself been a battered wife. Most of the women who volunteer for the crisis service have been victims of domestic violence. Like a majority of the women they attempt to help, it was initially difficult to break off with the men who beat them. Like the woman who attempted suicide, they were afraid of their husbands or lovers. They understand when callers continue to stay with the men who beat them. Some have called more than once. The woman who overdosed on Valium was too frightened to press charges against her husband. After assuring her that she was safe from her husband, the police released him just before she signed a statement that would have kept him in jail. He was big, the woman from the crisis service said. I shrank in a corner. He looked just like the guy who used to beat me up. The frightened wife left the police station with her husband. The woman from the crisis service thinks he moved her out of town. A typical case, she said. A woman held hostage, her children the weapon used to imprison her. If she did not break away from the pattern of violence and pain, her next attempt at suicide might succeed, or she might die from drug addiction. It was not unlikely that she would be killed by her husband. The crisis service was established in October 1979 to help break the pattern. Most of what the women who volunteer do is provide referral services, such as medical and legal help. They also set up sanctuaries when needed. They are often at risk. Some have been threatened by husbands or lovers of women they assist. They are severely criticized by men who are alarmed by the feminist movement and the growing determination of women to protect themselves at a time when the violence against them has increased. Each call received by the crisis service is logged. The information confidential and the daily reports do not identify the callers. Here are some examples picked at random and scrambled somewhat to protect the identities of the victims. Woman taken to hospital, badly beaten by husband of 5 months. Battered wife moved out of home and needs shelter where he cannot find her. Woman needs shelter, harassed by ex-husband, bringing children with her. Woman on the run, talked fast, will arrive for shelter in 1 hour, afraid of husband. Niece called, uncle threatening her aunt. Husband charged with kidnapping, tried to take children. Woman with 4 kids. Husband beat her severely, threatened her and kids with gun. Police called, took gun and husband. Woman asking for shelter if she decides to leave. Boyfriend of rape victim asks what he can do to help her. She is withdrawn, unable to respond physically. He wants some reading material on rape. Woman married 9 months, husband an alcoholic. She lost first husband and oldest daughter in a fire several years ago. Younger children ordered to in-laws by court. Present alcoholic husband shouts at her after drinking every night. She is very nervous, needs company. Husband brandished gun at wife and girlfriend. He took kids and left. She wants to file assault charges, wants names of attorneys. Woman called in regard to 13-year-old daughter who is having problems after short stay with dad, who lives in another city. Woman says husband's father a drinker and batterer. Woman's boyfriend tried to strangle her. She also has head injuries. Woman beaten by husband, put in shelter. Woman afraid of motorcycle club, wants shelter. Woman choked by husband, held her on bed, threatened her with gun. Woman's husband jealous of her job and friends, poured gas all over bedroom, himself and wife, threatened to burn. Unemployed husband tries to kill wife, shot arrows at her, smothered her, slapped and beat her. Boyfriend beats woman, kicks her out of house. She stays one night in shelter, waiting for emergency money from family in another state. Woman trapped at home in terror for several days. Husband slaps her, spits and urinates on her, pulls her hair and threatens to kill her. Woman forced into sex, put in shelter. The list of abuse seems unending. More women are assaulted by men. And the more women attempt to defend themselves, the more brutal are the men who assault them. The times do not favor gentleness. The hardening of the nation makes life more dangerous for women. the women of the Clatsop County Crisis Service struggle along, often disillusioned, often in despair. The calls come in. And that was something I wrote, beating her up. And I first wrote it for the North Coast Times-Eagle in January 1980. This is Michael McCusker. Rembrandt van Rijn died today, October 4th, 1669, at age 63.